Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Leviticus chapter 15. I'm going to cover verses 1 through 33, laws about bodily discharges. Our context is this. In chapter 14, the last part of the chapter, we talked about laws for cleansing houses from mildew. The first part of chapter 14 was an even previous audio, which was talking about laws for cleansing people with skin diseases. So now we start with Leviticus 15. Verses 1 and 2. The Lord also spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when any man has a discharge from his body, his discharge is unclean." Now, God speaking to Moses and Aaron, as I've said in other videos, in other audios, that it's interesting how the Lord sometimes speaks to Moses, sometimes he speaks to Aaron, and sometimes he speaks to both. I haven't figured out the reason for that, but both are responsible. They, of course, are going to instruct the priest and the people. And so the Lord said to them, "Tell the people, speak to the sons of Israel, say to them, when any man has a discharge from his body." Now we're going to talk about men's discharges for the first half of this chapter, women's discharges in the last half of the chapter. What kind of discharge is meant here? The NIV Study Bible says it's either diarrhea or an urethral discharge. Urethral means through the penis. How do we know this? According to the NIV Study Bible, quote, "The contamination of anything under the man," verse 10, "whether he sat," verses 4, 6, and 9, "or lay," verse 4, "on it," indicates that the bodily discharge had to do with the buttocks or genitals. So we're talking about either anal or urethral discharges. If it's a urethral discharge, it could be a seminal discharge or a bloody discharge or both. This is not talking about normal healthy discharges of semen. We're going to hit that in another verse, but this is talking about unhealthy discharges. Now, Adam Clark says that this discharge that's mentioned here is either a bad infection or a, quote, "criminal indulgence," unquote. I love that old-fashioned language. Clark says this means it could be a sexually transmitted disease. In other words, could be, but might not be. Just could be you get sick and have some kind of a discharge. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown tends to think that this has to do with sexual impropriety, this disease that causes this discharge, because Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the laws were, quote, "well calculated not only to prevent contagion, but to discourage the excesses of licentious indulgence." Now, we're going to talk a little bit later about, or right now, actually, why these discharges would make somebody unclean, as the law says in verse 2, unclean. Well, is that talking about hygiene? Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown loves to talk about the health aspects of the Levitical law. They say that this law is, quote, "well calculated to prevent contagion." Okay, could be. And then Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown also say, as I just quoted, that these laws were designed to discourage sexual immorality. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say this, quote, "these laws are, quote, well calculated to discourage the excesses of licentious indulgence." However, that view is not taken by everybody. Here's a quote from the pulpit commentary, quote, "we are not to look for a moral basis for the regulation on account of any vicious habit connected with such issues." And I agree with that totally, because it covers both. You can have a sexually transmitted disease, but you could also just have a disease in which you're perfectly innocent. That's not the point. The point is you got uncleanness, sickness, and blood coming out. And it could be just diarrhea, or bloody diarrhea, or something like that. That's obviously unclean. And there's going to be health implications from that, too, because you have some kind of discharge like that. Yeah, that could pass disease. But to me, the main reason for all these laws to make you unclean is to point out to the people that two things are not to be associated with the temple worship: sex and blood. Blood, not because there's anything immoral with blood or even hygienically unclean about blood. It's just blood. Life is in the blood. The blood's going to be used for sacrifices to take away the sins of the people ritually. And therefore, we can't have that associated with anything that has to do with the temple. So you get involved with normal activities that have blood involved in it, you're going to be segregated from the temple. Likewise, sex is segregated out. If any of these discharges have to do, like a seminal discharge would obviously be related to sex, well, we're going to keep sex away from the temple, because oftentimes people in their pagan idolatrous practices would use temple prostitutes, so that's bad. So we're going to keep that away from the temple. Also, as John Gill says in another context somewhere, he says that sex is related to original sin. And so therefore, if there's a seminal discharge, that has to do with sex and that has to do with original sin. We want to keep that away from the temple because the temple is designed to do away with sin. So I think those are the symbolic ceremonial reasons why these laws in chapter 15 against discharges are promulgated. I don't think the main reason is for hygiene. I don't think the main reason is discourage immorality. I mean, think about discouraging immorality. Is that really going to discourage immorality? You're going to get pronounced unclean? Well, whoop-de-doo. You can't go to the temple till tonight or even after 7 days maybe. How is that going to discourage immorality? It seems to me that the laws that say if you have sex with somebody that ain't your wife, you either be stoned to death or, you know, as we go through the adultery laws, that's bad business. That's much worse than being pronounced unclean. So I think these are ritual reasons more than hygienic or moral reasons that these laws are given. We go now to Leviticus 15, verses 3 through 7. This, moreover, shall be his uncleanness in his discharge. It is his uncleanness whether his body allows its discharge to flow or whether his body obstructs its discharge. Verse 4, every bed on which the person with the discharge lies becomes unclean, and everything on which he sits becomes unclean. Anyone, moreover, who touches his bed shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. And whoever sits on the thing on which the man with the discharge has been sitting shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. And whoever touches the person with the discharge shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. All right, we've got three different situations in which uncleanness shall transfer from the unclean discharger to another person. You got a bed, so if the person with the discharge lies on a bed and somebody else lies on that bed, boom, the other person is unclean. If the person with the discharge sits on a chair or a couch or something and another person sits on it nor touches it, boom, he's unclean until evening. And likewise, if somebody just touches the person itself, not an object of furniture which the person touches, but the unclean person himself, the discharger himself, well, then if you touch that person, then you become unclean. And becoming unclean means that you have to wash your body, wash your garments, and even after you wash, you're still unclean until evening. I suppose if you don't wash your body, don't wash your garments, you're still unclean. You got to do both. You got to wait till the sun goes down, and you got to wash your body and wash your garments. Now, all of that puts a line around these bodily discharges, a clear, bright red line, so that people know we're not going to have anything to do with these discharges and go into the temple. Because that's what it means. When you're unclean, you can't go to the temple. You can't go into the courtyard. You can't have a peace offering. You can't offer a sacrifice to the priest of any kind of sacrifice. You can't do it. You can't be involved with the temple service. Now, things become unclean when the person discharging lies upon the bed. That takes care of discharges, bloody discharges from the anus. Things on which he sits become unclean. Verse 4, that takes care of bloody or seminal discharges from the genitals. We go now to Leviticus 15, 8 through 11. Or if the man with the discharge spits on one who is clean, he too shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. That means the spittee, the person who was spit upon, shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. And obviously, the man with the discharge is already unclean. He's going to have to go through a cleansing ritual, which we'll talk about in a minute. This is talking about somebody who comes in contact with him by being spit upon. Verse 9, every saddle on which the person with the discharge rides becomes unclean. Whoever then touches any of the things which were under him shall be unclean until evening. And he who carries them shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. So if you touch the saddle blanket, sit on the saddle blanket, touch the saddle blanket, carry the saddle blanket, you're unclean too, because that saddle blanket has become in contact with some kind of discharge from the anus or the genitals. Verse 11, likewise, whomever the one with the discharge touches without having rinsed his hands in water shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. All right, let's start with verse 8 and discuss the issue of why would a man with a discharge spit upon one who was clean? Why would he do that? Well, he could do it purposely, and I guess that's possible. Got angry at him or something, and the law would cover that situation. But I suppose that most of the situations is talking about when the person spits not on purpose, not purposely. It's not unusual for somebody to spit on somebody else with purpose, as John Gill says. So it would probably refer to things like coughing when spit gets on somebody by accident. And of course, there would be hygiene implications here because spit could carry the disease, as we're well aware, with the COVID-19 panic. We really don't want to spit on a cough on somebody when during the pandemic. So there could be health implications. But again, I think that the main reason of this is just to separate out that disease, which is a result of sin, and the blood, which the life is in the blood, and that's used for sacrifices. All that stuff needs to be separated from the temple ritual. Now it says every saddle in verse 9 on which the person rides and discharges shall become unclean. That takes care of any discharge from either the penis or the buttocks. Both will infect the saddle, because a saddle is just like a bed that's lain upon. Now it says in verse 10, whoever touches any of the things on the saddle where the man with a discharge sat, anybody who touches those things, the saddle blankets and so forth, they shall be unclean. But it doesn't say they have to wash until evening. It says he who carries those things on the saddle, the unclean things on the saddle, that person who carries them shall wash his clothes and bathe in water. Well, does this mean that if you just touch the saddle, you don't have to wash, but if you touch the saddle blankets, you don't have to wash yourself and wash your clothes? But if you carry the saddle blankets, you do have to wash your clothes and bathe in water? I don't think so. I think you probably have to in both instances, you touch the unclean cloth, you're going to have to wash your body and wash your clothes. Now let's look at verse 11 here. It's a little bit unclear. Likewise, whomever the one with the discharge touches without having rinsed his hands. Who hasn't rinsed his hands? The toucher or the one touched? Well, it seems to be the consensus of every commentator I read. It's talking about the toucher, the one with the discharge. So whomever the one with the discharge touches without having rinsed the hands of the one who has the discharge, if he doesn't wash his hands, the one who is touched by him shall have to be unclean and wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean till evening. Now this is interesting, because if the person who has the discharge manages to rinse his hands, he can touch whoever he wants without making him unclean. And I guess that was to make it convenient to handle things. He's sick and so forth, and if you go up and touch the sick man, you become unclean, then nobody's going to want to have anything to do with him to get him well again, to take care of him. But if the one with the discharge just simply rinses hands, the person who touches him shall not be unclean. Now, the person that doesn't have the discharge, he can't lie on the bed where the man with the discharge lies, or sit on the furniture where the man with the discharge sits, but he can touch him as long as the person with the discharge rinses his hands. The Holman Christian Study Bible translation of verse 11 is a little clearer. If the man with the discharge touches anyone without first rinsing his hands in water, the person who was touched is to wash his clothes and bathe with water. Now, I don't know why a person with a discharge would want to actually touch someone. I guess maybe he wants to hand him his hand to help him out of bed or anything like that. That's fine, but he's got to be careful. He's got to rinse his hands first. All that rinsing of hands in the water, of course, would make things cleaner, hygienically cleaner. Notice that this is a direct touch of the one who is discharging. The spread of uncleanliness mentioned before that we just talked about was by touching relevant material objects such as a saddle, a bed, or a couch, or a chair, but now it's a direct touch, skin to skin. A direct touch could avoid passing uncleanliness by the discharger's washing of his hands. The person with the discharge washes his hands. He doesn't transmit his uncleanness. Now, all of these rules do seem to indicate the disease was contagious or might be contagious. However, the word clean all the way through here, and we need to remember, it means ceremonially clean, not medically clean. We go down to Leviticus 15, verse 12. However, an earthenware vessel which the person with the discharge touches shall be broken, and every wooden vessel shall be rinsed in water. Now, the earthenware vessel, the Holman Christian Study Bible translates that as clay pot. Earthenware vessel is the New American Standard. Why would it be destroyed if the person with the discharge touches it? Well, first of all, it's cheap. These clay pots are cheap. Second of all, is they're porous, which means they could soak up uncleanliness. Now, wooden vessels were not destroyed. And you might say, well, wooden vessels can soak up uncleanness too. Well, maybe so, but not if it's a hard wood, something like cedar. Something real hard might not soak it up. But clay is definitely going to soak up uncleanliness, especially when the pottery is unglazed. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this, Porous clay is, quote, extremely liable to imbibe small particles of impure matter. Yes. John Gill disagrees somewhat. He says that, no, it's the reason it should be destroyed is not because of the... In fact, it's hard to find a reason why clay pots are destroyed and wooden vessels are not to be destroyed. The reason is in the mind of God, and we can't know it. Well, I don't agree with that. I think it's because they're cheap and they're porous. That's why they're discharged. Wooden vessels would be hard on the average Israelite, and the law had sympathy for economic considerations for the Israelites who were under the law. Now, Ellicott has an interesting comment about these clay pots that are touched. Quote, the only instance where an earthen vessel touched on the outside was defiled. Talking about this verse that we're reading here in Leviticus 15, is the only instance where an earthen vessel touched on the outside was defiled. Thus again, showing the intense loathing with which the guilt of this kind of infirmity was regarded. Now you notice here Ellicott's implying that the seminal or bloody discharge had to do with some kind of immorality the person with the discharge had committed. It never says that. That's just his assumption. A lot of people assume there's sexual immorality here. But it doesn't say that. You can be innocently discharging blood or semen. But it is interesting. This is the only time when you touch an earthenware vessel on the outside, not on the inside. There's other examples of inside with the clay pots being touched on the inside by something impure. They had to be destroyed. But this is on the outside. Now, any time the earthenware vessel is touched, it doesn't mention anything about rinsing of hands or washing of hands. So I assume that even though you can touch a person and not make him clean by washing your hands, it's not so with an earthenware vessel. You can wash your hands all you want. You touch the vessel, you'll break it up. I guess you can't break up the person. You can't destroy the person, but you can destroy a clay pot. That's easy to do. We go now to Leviticus 15, verses 13 through 15. Now when the man with the discharge becomes cleansed from his discharge, then he shall count off for himself 7 days for his cleansing. He shall then wash his clothes and bathe his body in running water and will become clean. Then on the 8th day he shall take for himself 2 turtle doves or 2 young pigeons and come before the Lord to the doorway of the tent of meeting and give them to the priest. And the priest shall offer them, one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. So the priest shall make atonement on his behalf before the Lord because of his discharge. Now notice here the man with the discharge, he's got to do more than just wash his clothes and wash his garments and stay unclean to evening. That was for the people who the man of the discharge affected by touching things. This is the man himself. He's got to go through more than that. He's got to go through 7 days of being uncleaned. Not just one day until evening, but 7 days. And he's got to offer sacrifice. Now, in verse 13, when it says, now when the man with the discharge becomes cleansed from his discharge, that's not talking about Levitical cleanse. That happened 7 days later. It's talking about cleansed from his discharge. His discharge has stopped flowing, as John Gill points out. And notice that it's not the priest that decides this is in the case with leprosy. It's the person himself. He says, okay, looks like it stopped. And then he counts off for himself. He doesn't go to the priest. He counts off for himself 7 days. And then he washes his clothes and he's clean without having to go through the temple or the tabernacle to the priesthood. Now he does this for 7 days. 7, of course, is a symbolic number for perfection, divine maturity, and completeness. So the idea is he's completely clean after 7 days. And he can go back and offer his sacrifices in the tabernacle. Now, he also has to offer 2 offerings, a burnt and a sin offering. Of course, a sin offering is to take care of sin, and the burnt offering is to show total devotion and complete surrender to God. And we've talked about that many, many times. And, of course, turtle doves and pigeons are often the offerings of the poor. For example, when a mother is being purified after childbirth and she's poor, these are her offerings. If you have a leper who is poor and is cleansed from his leprosy, or skin disease, I should say, then the turtle dove and pigeon are offered. But in this case, in the case of someone with a discharge, it doesn't matter whether he's rich or poor, it's just a bird. I guess it might have been too onerous just because somebody got sick to make them sacrifice one of their lambs, 2 of their lambs, for sin and burnt offerings. These birds would be offered at the doorway of the tent of meeting, it says in verse 14. And of course, the doorway of the tent of meeting, that's the gate that's facing east. The gate faces east. If you go through the gate facing west, you're heading toward the Holy of Holies, going toward the bronze altar in the courtyard there. And I've always had a little question. All this stuff that's done at the doorway, is it on the outside of the doorway before they go into the tent of meeting, into the courtyard of the tabernacle, or is it after they go through the doorway and are in the courtyard? I think I've read enough. I can't put my finger on it, but it's probably within the doorway of the tent of meeting, on the inside in the courtyard. We go now to Leviticus 15, verses 16 through 18. Now, if a man has a seminal emission, now we're moving now from just a discharge, but now we're going to a particular type of discharge, a seminal emission. We've talked about anal and penile emissions, bloody, seminal. We've done all that. Now we're just talking about a particular type, a seminal emission, emission of sperm. Verse 16, now if a man has a seminal emission, he shall bathe all his body in water and be unclean until evening. As for any garment or any leather on which there is seminal emission, it shall be washed with water and be unclean until evening. If a man lies with a woman, this is verse 18, if a man lies with a woman so that there is a seminal emission, they shall both bathe in water and be unclean until evening. Now I'm going to go out of order here and take verse 18 first because it's easy. If a man lies with a woman as a man and a wife, having sex is a seminal, well, I guess it would include somebody that's not a man and a wife, but then you got other problems, other legal sanctions that apply. So this is assuming a marriage situation. If a man lies with a woman so that there's a seminal emission. Now, the question is what type of seminal emission is this? Well, here's four options. Option number one, there's no question here. In verse 18, it's the seminal emission from normal sexual intercourse. Now, notice that the man and the wife are both unclean, and they both are unclean until evening. It's interesting. You have sex, you don't go to the temple. Again, we want to keep sex separate from the temple. One step further away from temple prostitution. I say temple, I meant tabernacle, because temple's not built yet. All of these laws, of course, would apply to the temple when the temple was built, but we're talking about the tabernacle right now. Now, let me ask you a question. Why would a seminal emission be considered unclean? Could it be for reasons of health? Well, of course not. There's nothing unhealthy about sperm. I mean, that's how babies are born. There's nothing unhealthy about it. So why is the seminal emission unclean? Well, I think it's because semen is connected with life, just like life is in the blood, life is in the semen, and we want to keep that separate from the rituals in the temple, in the tabernacle, which give spiritual life. And so these rituals here kind of segregate semen as something that's very important. Well, maybe so, but John Gill says this is a reference to the fact that all births create babies who are born in original sin, and we want to keep original sin away from the tabernacle. Doesn't mean the sex was sinful, obviously not, but the baby that comes from the sex, he is sinful because of original sin. His sin is passed down from Adam. Therefore, we're going to keep the man and the woman who created that sinful human being away from the temple so that the temple, the tabernacle, could be totally divorced from any hint of sin. I think that makes sense. So that's verse 18. Now let's go back to verse 16. Now if a man has a seminal emission, and the question is what type of seminal emission is talked about in verse 16? Well, here are four possibilities. Option number one, this is a seminal emission from normal sexual activity. Gill says, no, it's not, because that was described in verse 18, which I just talked about, and I think Gill's right about that. So we'll knock out option one. How about option number two, a voluntary emission? Now, Gill mentions this and says, no, it's not a voluntary emission. Well, how do you voluntarily make sperm emit? Well, that would refer to wag flagging, stump bumping, pole rolling, tickle pickling, if you get my drift. I don't think the law had anything to say about that. Although if that did happen, I mean, I suppose he's unclean just like any other case, but I don't think the law specifically is talking about that here. The third probability, it's the seminal emission comes from disease or from accident. Well, I don't think so. Gill denies that, and I agree, because if it was a seminal emission from disease, there'd be a 7-day ritual cleansing period plus a sacrifice, as we just talked about in verses 13 through 15. So I don't think it's talking about a diseased seminal emission. So what does that leave? It leaves an involuntary emission, i.e. a nocturnal emission, where the man has no control over it and he has an emission. Now, Ellicott agrees with that. Gill agrees with that. Ellicott says this is, quote, an involuntary emission as in Deuteronomy 23:10, which I'll read now. Deuteronomy 23:10, quote, if there is among you any man who is unclean because of a nocturnal emission, then he must go outside the camp. He must not reenter the camp. Colin Delitch agrees with this. So that's enough authority. Verse 16 is talking about involuntary nocturnal emission. He bathes unclean till evening. No sacrifice involved. Likewise, normal seminal omissions from marriage sex in verse 18, same thing, you wash it unclean till evening. It's a minor inconvenience. And in either one of these cases, if the semen hits garment or leather or something and somebody touches it, they'll become unclean until evening. We go now to verses 19 through 24, and we'll turn to discharges from women. Leviticus 15, 19 through 24. When a woman has a discharge, if her discharge in her body is blood, she shall continue in her menstrual impurity for 7 days, and whoever touches her shall be unclean until evening. This is your normal menstrual period. Makes a woman ritually unclean for 7 days. Not morally unclean, not medically unclean. There's nothing medically wrong with somebody that's menstruating. That's normal. It's not sickness. And whoever touches her shall be unclean. That means ritually unclean. Can't have a fellowship meal, a peace offering meal in the temple, and so forth. Now, John Gill says that this 7 days of uncleanliness means that she couldn't go into the temple courtyard for 7 days. That's where I get the idea that all this stuff that happens at the doorway of the temple, this passing of animals to the priest and so forth, is done on the inside of the doorway. Men and women could both go into the courtyard. Well, if she's unclean, she can't go into the courtyard, but she could go into the camp and into her house, as John Gill says. Notice that in the case of menstruation, there was no sacrifice required. Can you imagine every time a woman had a period, she had to go offer an animal in the tabernacle? What a pain that would be. But no, it's not required. She just has to stay away for 7 days. Verse 20, everything which she lies during her menstrual period should be unclean. This is just like these unhealthy disease discharges we talked about earlier. For a man, it's the same thing for a woman. It's not a disease, but it's a period. So if she sits on a chair, lies on a bed, and a visitor or somebody else in the family sits on the chair and lies on the bed, they become unclean. And to become clean, they have to wash their clothes and their body and be unclean until evening. Now, again, you might ask, why should the woman be declared unclean ceremonially, ritually, Levitically? Why should she be declared unclean just because she had a period? Well, because life's in the blood. We want to separate that blood out from the uses of the blood in the temporal rituals, the sacrifice, the sprinkling of the blood on the horns of the bronze altar, the pouring of the blood at the base of the altar, and so forth. That's special blood. We want to keep normal blood away from that. Now, verse 24 presents an interesting problem. If a man actually lies with her so that her menstrual impurity is on him, he shall be unclean 7 days. Well, we have some other laws that talk about a man lying with the woman in her period, and these laws suggest, actually require, a much stiffer penalty. Leviticus 20:18, if there is a man who lies with a menstruous woman and uncovers her nakedness, has sex with her, he has laid bare her flow, and she has exposed the flow of her blood. Thus, both of them shall be cut off from among their people, not unclean for 7 days, but cut off. Well, that's a much more serious penalty, whether it means exile or death. Cut off is unclear, but nonetheless, it's a lot more serious than 7 days of uncleanliness. Leviticus 18:19 says this, also you shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness during her menstrual impurity. Ah, so you actually were not supposed to have sex with a woman when she was having her period, and if you did, you'd be cut off. But, that's in Leviticus 20:18 and Leviticus 18:19, but in our verse here, Leviticus 15:24, it's just 7 days of uncleanliness. Well, how do we reconcile the difference? Well, the only way to reconcile it is by the knowledge of the man who does this. Does he know she's having a period, or does she not know she's having a period? Well, let's look at the two options here. In the case in Leviticus 18 and 20 where the man having sex with the menstruous woman is cut off, he knew that the woman was in her period, and which means that the flow of the period started before the intercourse, and he knew and the woman knew. Okay? But now, in our case here in Leviticus 15:24, it must be that the menstrual flow started in the midst of intercourse when the man didn't know that the woman was about to have her period. Adam Clark says this, quote, in the former case, that means Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 20, where the man is cut off, in that case, Moses speaks of the act when both the man and woman were acquainted with the situation. In the latter, that's the case we're now here in Leviticus 15, verse 24. In the latter case, he speaks of a case where the circumstance was not known till afterwards. At least, so it appears these two places should be understood so as to be reconciled, and that's how I reconcile it. The knowledge of the parties involved, and again, this always brings to mind an incident that came up in my experience. I was going to a course on natural family planning, which involved having sex on certain days when you were infertile and not having sex when the woman was fertile. And so in order to keep track of that, they had these charts, and an X indicated a day on the calendar when you had sex, and then they had a little blanked out spot for the period when the wife had her was having a period. And somebody had a chart there with an X that was over that menstrual period. And somebody raised the hand when they saw it on the overhead projector, and they said, well, but isn't that sinful? The Bible says in Leviticus that you're not supposed to have sex with a woman having menstruation. You'd be cut off. Well, what's the simple answer to that objection? This is the Old Testament law, folks. We are in the New Testament. We're not under this law. This does not have anything to do with New Testament Christians. This has to do with the temple or the tabernacle ritual and the Jews under that law. Now, one more issue before we leave verse 24. It said every bed on whom the menstruating woman, after she has sex with her husband, the bed on which he lies shall be unclean. Not just the woman, but the man. Of course, the bed would be unclean because she lay on it too. But this is in case the bed, man, let's say the man gets up and goes to another bed in the house and lies on it. Well, it's unclean. Now, does that mean that somebody who touches that bed then also becomes unclean? Probably so. It doesn't say so in the verse, but probably so, because this uncleanness passed around. We go now to Leviticus 15, verses 25 through 29. Now, if a woman has a discharge of her blood many days, not at the period of her menstrual impurity, or if she has a discharge beyond that period, all the days of her impure discharge, she shall continue as though in her menstrual impurity she is unclean. Now, this is talking about, obviously, discharges of blood that are not healthy. There's something wrong. Verse 26, any bed on which she lies all the days of her discharge shall be to her like her bed at menstruation, in other words, unclean. And everything on which she sits shall be unclean, like her uncleanness at the time. In other words, just like when she had a period, if she has a post-period flow of blood, well, that makes everything unclean too. Verse 27, likewise, whoever touches them shall be unclean and shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. And by the way, when it says his, that means men or a woman. Anybody that touches a bed, touches a couch, touches a garment, anything that's been affected by that post-menstrual flow of blood shall be unclean. Nothing unusual about that. Verse 28, when she becomes clean from her discharge, that means when she stopped having the discharge. It doesn't mean Levitically clean. It means she's actually not having a discharge anymore. No more blood. She shall count off for herself 7 days. She doesn't have to do it with the priest. She does it herself, and afterwards she will be clean. And that clean means Levitically clean. Then on the eighth day, well, she's Levitically clean as she prepares to give her sacrifices. That will make her completely Levitically clean. Verse 29, then on the eighth day she shall take for herself two turtle doves or two young pigeons and bring them into the priest to the doorway of the tent of meeting. The priest shall offer the one for a sin offering, the other for a burnt offering, so the priest shall make atonement on her behalf before the Lord because of her impure discharge. Now, all this is pretty repetitious. The only difference is it's talking about an unnatural discharge, not a normal menstrual discharge where there was no disease present, but this is some kind of disease. Now, we'll point out that a postpartum discharge is not a disease. That's normal, but that would be included here even though it's not diseased, where you have a woman has a baby and she keeps bleeding after the baby is born. Well, that would apply here too, even though it's not diseased. It's still post-menstrual. I don't know if you'd say it's post-menstrual, but it's included in the same type of bloody discharges. Let's put it this way, a non-menstrual bloody discharge. Same rules, unclean until evening. 7 days, not till evening, excuse me, unclean for 7 days. Eighth day, you go offer two turtle doves or two young pigeons. And again, this is not whether the woman is poor or not. Two turtle doves and two young pigeons, whether she's got the money or not. Now, at verse 25, it says that this woman with the discharge of blood post-menstruation is unclean. And the question we can ask ourselves is, what are the consequences of being unclean? Well, first of all, she's kept apart from her husband, because we don't want to get him unclean now, do we? Second result is she can't go to the tabernacle. The third result is she cannot touch anybody without making them unclean. just like in their menstrual impurity, no difference. Fourth consequence of being unclean is no one could touch her things without becoming unclean. So you can't touch her, you can't touch her things, her garments, her bed, her chair. She can't go to the tabernacle. Well, I've talked about all that, but I haven't mentioned about being kept apart from a husband. She can't have sex with a husband. Notice this period of uncleanness is also a period of discomfort for the woman. That must be a terrible situation to be bleeding like that all the time. I think of the woman with a hemorrhage of blood that Jesus healed on his way to Capernaum to heal somebody else, and then she touched his garment and she was immediately made heal. You're bleeding all the time. What a terrible situation. And again, the law is not meant to show any kind of disrespect for women that are sick or to cause us not to have sympathy for people that are sick. It has nothing to do with that. It's just trying to show that life is in the blood. You keep that blood separate from the tabernacle ritual. Now, the two turtle doves or the two pigeons, those are the same offerings as for the man with a seminal issue. And again, it's the same with that situation. It doesn't matter whether the man with a seminal problem or the woman with the post-menstrual bloody discharge. It doesn't matter whether they're rich or poor. Now, note, I said that when a normally menstruating woman has a period, she doesn't have to offer a sacrifice. John Gill says that there are some commentators that say that she does have to offer a turtle dove. And I poo-pooed that idea, and I still poo-poo it, because why would God make somebody have an appear? That's every month. You just say, oh, here we go again. I have to get a turtle dove and a pigeon to go sacrifice. I don't think so. We go now to Leviticus 15, 31 through 33, and we'll finish up chapter 15. Thus you shall keep the sons of Israel separated from their uncleanness, so that they will not die in their uncleanness by their defiling my tabernacle that is among them. This is the law for the one with the discharge, and for the man who has a seminal emission, so that he may be unclean, and for the woman who is ill because of her menstrual impurity, and for the one who has a discharge, whether a male or female or a man who lies with an unclean woman. That's just a summary of all what we've just read about all the different cases that might happen with discharges. Verse 31 says this, thus you shall keep the sons of Israel separate from their uncleanness. This is addressed to the priest. Now, I've already mentioned as I went through here that it was the people themselves who were responsible to maintain cleansing in those cases. They would count off the 7 days after their discharge stopped. But ultimately, the priests were responsible for this. They're the ones that had to say, did this person offer his sacrifice like he was supposed to? Notice that what happens if somebody disobeyed these laws of uncleanness dealing with discharges? They're going to die in their uncleanness. You shall keep the sons of Israel separated from their uncleanness so that they will not die. That shows how important God considered all these regulations, as John Gill says. This is not just some minor bureaucratic thing which is never enforced. It shows that God was serious about his ceremonial laws for purification, but ultimately, of course, it shows how serious he was about dealing with sin. Now, how are they going to die? Somebody who walks into the temple after having a bloody discharge or something, into the tabernacle, let's say he has a peace offering meal, fellowship meal, and he's bleeding or he's leaking semen or whatever. He says he's going to die. Now, the options of how he might die are this. First option is God could kill him directly, or it could be he's turned over to the judges. The judges hear his case, realize he violated the Levitical law, and then the judges would execute him. I don't know how it happened, but I suspect the latter. I suspect the Israelites were responsible for enforcing their own laws here. That's serious business. Now, notice that what the guilty parties, the people committing these infractions, what are they going to die from? By their defiling my tabernacle, verse 31. And that really isn't that the point of this whole chapter here. Defiling the tabernacle. You walk into the tabernacle when you're bleeding or you're sick with bloody flux or pus coming out of your orifices. You've defiled God's tabernacle and you're going to die. God's very serious about this. Again, the whole purpose of the law of Leviticus is to show holiness, how mankind in his sin is separate from God and God is holy and above all that. The more you read Leviticus, the more you realize this is a legitimate aim of God. It doesn't seem so strange and weird when you read all these laws. You realize there's a purpose behind it. God is holy, 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 holy. That's the purpose of Leviticus. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished with chapter 15 of Leviticus. We are now prepared to, in our next audio, move on to Leviticus 16 and we'll talk about the very famous Jewish Day of Atonement. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.